Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
How can an emotionally charged, spiritually fervent, and fast-growing religious movement maintain its momentum over the course of a century? Does the increasing size of a denomination necessarily lead to institutional sclerosis, which may threaten to slow the growth of the movement and sap some of its original passion? What is the tension between charismata, or the emotionally laden spiritual energy that new churches often rely upon, and the historical institutionalization of belief? On today's podcast, we are going to examine these questions in the context of Pentecostalism, one of the fastest-growing religious movements in the world over the past century. In particular, we will be talking about one of the largest branches of Pentecostalism, the World Assemblies of God Fellowship. In the United States, the Assemblies of God has roughly 2.9 million adherents, making it the ninth largest religious grouping in the country. Internationally, the Assemblies claim upwards of nearly 63 million members spread across every corner of the globe. In 1989, the guest of today's podcast, Margaret Paloma, wrote a critically acclaimed book entitled The Assemblies of God at the Crossroads, Charisma and Institutional Dilemmas. This book openly speculated as to whether or not the Assemblies had reached a plateau in their growth, and whether or not the denomination would see a decline in membership. Not only was the denomination reeling from sexual scandals befalling two of their most publicly known preachers, Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart, but the successful spread of the church from its inner-city moorings to the more sedate confines of modern suburbia meant that its parishioners, who were once known as holy rollers for their exceedingly exuberant behavior, were now becoming more tame and less passionate in their expressions of faith. Today, Margaret Paloma is revisiting her classic work with a new book entitled The Assemblies of God, Godly Love and the Revitalization of American Pentecostalism, just released by NYU Press and co-authored with her colleague John Green. We'll provide a link to this book on our website so you can take a look at it and possibly purchase it just out. Margaret Paloma is a professor of sociology at the University of Akron, and author of several other books in addition to the two mentioned, including Mainstream Mystics, The Toronto Blessing and Reviving Pentecostalism, The Politics of Protestant Preachers, and Blood and Fire, Godly Love and an Emerging Pentecostal Church. Margaret, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be with you.
That's great. I'm going to apologize to our listeners a little bit beforehand because I'm just recovering from a cold here, and the topic that we have today has a lot of multisyllabic words, revitalization and glossolalia, so if I have problems pronouncing this, I'm just going to ask for your forgiveness at the outset here. And before we begin our discussion of the Assemblies of God, which a lot of your work focuses on, I think it'd be helpful to gain a better understanding of the Pentecostal umbrella under which this church fits. In a recent podcast we did with Jim Wellman, we talked about the differences between evangelicals and mainline Protestants, but Pentecostals, they seem to fit another religious category. What exactly distinguishes a Pentecostal from an evangelical or a mainline Protestant?
Well, Tony, I would agree with you. Pentecostals do make up their own category, and they're growing worldwide, as you've pointed out already. There are approximately a half billion Pentecostals scattered throughout the globe, and the Assemblies of God is, of course, only one approach to Pentecostalism. The way I look at it, especially when we're looking at it on the American scene, American Pentecostals are, for the most part, evangelicals, but fewer evangelicals would consider themselves to be Pentecostals. In fact, Pentecostals have frequently been criticized by evangelicals in the past. There's a better relationship between the two components now, but there has been a lot of criticism, and particularly of their use of the gifts of the Spirit that we'll talk about later. But the way I look at it and the way others have seen it, evangelicalism plus tongues is often seen as a good description of Pentecostalism. So it's evangelical plus something else. I would say it's more than just glossolalia or speaking in tongues that has been added, but rather Pentecostalism represents a unique worldview. It's really an alternate worldview to the modern worldview. In some ways, I see evangelicalism as an outgrowth of modernity. The modern culture kind of was critical of fundamentalism and its more refined form, evangelicalism. And so evangelicals responded with head arguments. It's very cognitive. Pentecostalism, on the other hand, although accepting much of the definitions of theology that evangelicals would advance, they're saying, hey, experience is important, because Pentecostalism was really born out of religious experience. So it's more than just plus tongues. Mm-hmm. It's plus healing, plus miracles, plus prophecy, plus prosperity in different definitions. It's much more than that. It's God moving and active in their lives.
Let me ask you a little bit about this issue of tongues and some of the other aspects of it. Again, you do a wonderful job describing Pentecostalism as a more emotionally laden movement relative to, say, evangelical Christianity. What is glossolalia, speaking in tongues? Describe this for our listeners who might not know what that is or have had experiences with it.
Okay, glossolalia, or speaking in tongues, is used two ways in Pentecostalism, and increasingly this is modified into a single way, but often in Pentecostal churches, there would be someone speaking out in what sounds like a language, but it's not a known language.
Mm-hmm.
A linguist has studied it, and they say there are certain characteristics of the language-like qualities, but it's no known language. And then in this service, this would be a public use of it, someone will come up with an interpretation. They have some kind of a sense of what God is saying through this language. So it was seen as being a kind of heavenly language. And this language can also be used, and now I would say is largely relegated to, a private prayer language.
Mm-hmm.
So when people speak in tongues, they believe they're speaking to God. It's a language that just seems to flow. It comes. You can stop it, start it for the most part. I hear accounts of some people saying they can't stop it. But by and large, it's pretty much of a voluntary thing. Once you start to do it, it's pretty natural. In fact, again, this is the way I look at it. We're probably all hardwired for it,
mm-hmm.
because Pentecostals aren't the only ones that have spoken in tongues or to be found with using glossolalia. Perhaps we're all hardwired for it, but in some approaches, some religions make room for it, and others do not. Does that help?
Yeah, that does. I mean, that seems to fit a lot of the description of what Pentecostalism is, the emotional laden aspect of it. A lot of people talk about speaking in tongues, but it is this filling with the Holy Spirit that manifests itself in a number of other ways, as you mentioned. The term I used in the introduction, holy rollers, has an interesting etymology to that. So where does that term holy rollers come from?
Well, actually, when I first started studying the Assemblies of God, everyone made quite a point of the fact they didn't roll in the aisles, and they never did, and I believed them. I would read about things, and I thought it was only the critics saying they rolled in the aisles. That is, until I started studying the revival of the 1990s,
mm-hmm.
and I actually saw people rolling in the aisles.
And that was that the Toronto Blessing movement?
That was in Toronto Blessing, and it was another. There were a number of different epicenters of that blessing, and of course, I spent most of my time at Toronto. And so when I saw it, and particularly when the first time, when this overweight woman got down on the floor, and she was laughing and laughing and rolling, and I thought, there is no way in the world she could be doing that just under her own volition. She didn't decide to lay on the floor and start rolling.
Mm-hmm.
It was phenomenal. And then I would see other people do it. That wasn't a prime physical manifestation there, but I did see it there. So I'm pretty sure Pentecostals rolled in the aisles at one time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always assumed holy rollers, I always thought of dice when I heard that term growing up, but it's rolling in the aisles, much like the Quakers back several hundred years ago.
Exactly. I believe, Tony, that a lot of religions have had these kinds of experiences that, again, they don't last without some kind of revitalization.
Yeah, and that's something we want to get into, and it's really fascinated me about your work. And in the book that we cited, your earlier one on the Assemblies of God at the Crossroad, you had noted that this issue of glossolalia, speaking in tongues, and these exuberant outbursts from the congregation sets up an interesting tension within the actual institution of the church, because if you have a number of people speaking to God directly during services and stuff, it could lead to a lot of multiple interpretations of theology, one could imagine.
Well, it could. Again, I find that a skilled pastor can really handle that without much difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, when they speak out in tongues, and I'm finding that to be less and less of a practice, and I don't see anyone actually stopping it, particularly in the neo-Pentecostal movement, not the Assemblies of God, but more independent types of movements that are really on the cutting edge of Pentecostalism today. Even there, I don't hear that speaking out in tongues and then waiting for an interpretation. It's just somehow fallen by the wayside, but they have all kinds of other manifestations. But tongues has become very important because when Pentecostalism first developed in the United States, tongues was seen as a kind of sign, and the paramount sign, especially in the Assemblies of God. It became a doctrine. And so at present, it is one of their statements of faith that speaking in tongues is the initial evidence of spirit baptism. And that's caused a lot of problems for the Assemblies of God, because a lot of people don't speak in tongues. But, you know, again, tongues is very much, I think, a part of most Pentecostals' spiritual repertoire. But it isn't the only one, and perhaps it isn't the most important. Often in my own research, it appears that tongues, for many people, might be one of the first experiences and kind of an open door that they go through, and then they become more open to other experiences.
Might those other important, you say tongues is not the most important aspect of faith. And it's one that we tend to focus on because it's very visible, and for people not within that tradition, it really stands out. But what would you consider to be some of the more important aspects of Pentecostal faith?
I see it as a whole different worldview, and I focus it on that worldview. You know, generally, we live in an as-is world. I see Pentecostalism living more in a subjunctive mode, the as-if, and that as-if is believing that somehow heaven can come to earth,
mm-hmm.
that heaven in some way invades earth, that we can do all kinds of things. There's all kinds of possibilities. And Pentecostalism at its best is open to these possibilities, particularly in the service of other people.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. You know, in terms of the possibilities, let's take something like healing. You know, for many churches, let's take the evangelicals again, because we did compare them, and we're trying to compare and contrast Pentecostals and evangelicals earlier. Many evangelicals were saying at one point in time, they're changing a little bit now, that healing was not a gift for today. That was a gift for the early church. I even learned that in Catholicism when I was growing up.
Right.
You know, that, yeah, there'd be some times it happened, but by and large, you go to doctors now. Well, the Pentecostals, again, at their best, are saying, yeah, you go to doctors, but God can heal directly. And in the kingdom of God, there really should be no illness. But it's not here yet, but we can help to usher that in.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at the possibilities here. Someone's sick, we pray with faith. We trust that God is going to heal, that he wants to heal. There's no debate about whether God heals today or doesn't heal today. And they have lots of stories that accompany this belief in healing.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing might go for many other gifts, like prophecy. Again, I believe that human beings are probably hardwired for another way of knowing besides the intellectual. We have other terms for it, maybe deja vu or, you know, clairvoyance or whatever. They would never use those terms. But they have a way of knowing that transcends the intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And they would call that the prophetic. And it's not necessarily, in fact, it isn't usually foretelling the future. It's a gift that they may see something going on in somebody else. And that means maybe offering a word of comfort or a word of encouragement. And they know this in a way that doesn't come from a natural way of knowing that we think of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody didn't tell them, they didn't read it. It's more an inner sense, and they respond to those inner senses that they would say the Holy Spirit working through them. So it's that, those kinds of, that's why I keep emphasizing it's another way of knowing, it's an alternate worldview. It's really an opening a world of possibilities.
And that does make sense. You talk about the name Pentecostalism and refers to the Pentecost and the coming down of heaven to earth to revitalize or to invigorate the church in that regard. So I can see how, that different way of knowing, that connection that one has, deeply felt faith coming down is an actually important aspect of this. Let me ask you a little bit about the history of Pentecostalism. A few minutes ago, you mentioned a neo-Pentecostal movement. So where was the Pentecostal movement birthed, and at least the modern Pentecostal movement birthed, and how has it changed over the past 100 years?
Okay, I think many historians would say that global Pentecostalism, for that matter, was birthed on Azusa Street in a revival in Los Angeles, California, between 1906 and 1909. Now, there are many other examples of similar occurrences other places, but what seemed to be important is that people were flocking to Azusa Street. It was a kind of pilgrimage spot, and then they were taking this, in quotes, experience, this Pentecostal experience, to other communities, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. So many would say that was the birthplace of Pentecostalism, Azusa Street in Los Angeles, between roughly 1906 and 1909. The Assemblies of God came out of that revival. It was, you find other groups identifying with it in different ways, but the Assemblies came out of a lot of independent people or churches that found that they had lost their home in evangelical-type churches. At that time, maybe we would have called them more fundamentalist churches. But whatever, they had lost their home there, and they were kind of wondering, okay, we need to affiliate. For one reason, as one historian pointed out, they wanted the discounts that came with being ordained that they could get from the railway. They needed travel across the country. They needed those discounts. And, of course, that was only one reason they came together. But they decided they were coming together just as a very loose fellowship in 1914 when they met in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And they wanted no theology. They wanted to just be a fellowship and a nice, loose grouping of coming together. Well, when they met again in 1916, they found that, quote, heresy had developed in their midst. There was a group denying the Trinity, or the belief in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit being together, one God. And they felt they could not let that go. In fact, they lost one quarter of their members over that, because this new group that became labeled the Oneness Movement, mm-hmm, developed out of their original group, the group they met in 1914. So the Assemblies of God was formed, and they developed a statement of faith that they still have, 16 fundamental principles, largely based on the fundamentals that were developed by the evangelicals. And then they added healing and tongues. So that was the beginning of the Assemblies of God. It's also the beginning of the Pentecostal movement, but you have many other branches of the Pentecostal movement that also developed out of Azusa Street, or like the Church of God, Cleveland, Tennessee, being affected by Azusa Street.
Mm-hmm. What are some of these other strands of Pentecostalism that we associate? The Assemblies of God is obviously the largest grouping within Pentecostalism, at least in the United States.
Well, not so.
Okay.
The Church of God in Christ, the African-American group, is actually fifth on the list of denominations in the United States. And the Assemblies of God is number nine. But it's the African-American group is larger.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, they, too, it's an interesting history because, unfortunately, although Azusa Street was characterized by its interracial nature and the nature of its gathering, in fact, some reporters that came to Azusa Street were horrified to find the blacks and the whites hugging and so on at this revival. Unfortunately, that didn't last. And there's a good deal of indication that the Assemblies of God was formed largely because they wanted a white organization, because they had already had contact with African Americans, the Church of God, that that were also touched by Azusa Street, and they were going to African bishops for their ordination.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this tie between the African Americans and the white church, unfortunately, didn't last, and it took another action in the 1990s to have a kind of reconciliation. So that's one group, just to make note that the Assemblies of God is not the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States.
And Pentecostal, for me, is just a fascinating organization. If you could consider it an organization, I mentioned at the outset, I think of it more as an umbrella grouping, and it really leads in many ways to the branching out of different movements and such, and in part that seems to be what feeds the revitalization of the movement over time. I mean, you're talking about different groupings or different movements. There's the Neo-Pentecostal movement that you'd mentioned before. Who are the Neo-Pentecostals?
Thank you, Tony, for getting me back on track. So we had that first phase, if you will, sometimes call it that first wave launched by Azusa Street. But I believe that probably started routinizing certainly by the end of the Second World War. And clearly there was another wave of revival that came out of Saskatchewan called the Latter Rain. And when it hit the United States, perhaps not surprisingly in light of sociological theory, the Assemblies of God was not in favor of it. In fact, none of the Pentecostals were. It was a new revival, similar to Azusa Street in many ways, and it was challenged and actually condemned by some of the Pentecostal groups. They don't take well to revival.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because they were born of revival.
Exactly, exactly. So you had both a healing movement and this Latter Rain going on at the same time. Probably the best-known name of that period would be someone like Oral Roberts,
mm-hmm.
who was operating in the healing ministry at that time. So that's considered by many people a kind of second wave. The third wave developed in the late 1960s and into the 1970s, and that was when Pentecostalism moved into the mainstream churches, including the Catholic Church. And it was a way of many of the groups were trying to combine this Pentecostal worldview and Pentecostal experiences within all of the, I'd say all of the mainstream denominations had this experience. I would also contend that it probably hasn't lasted in most of those groups. It's largely on the periphery because these groups are already routinized and in many ways don't take to the whole revival kind of thinking, and there's not a framework for it. So many people would leave those denominations and either go into independent denominations or into a group like the Assemblies of God. But again, that was considered the third wave of revival. For the Catholic charismatics, I'd say it's still viable in the Hispanic community, among Hispanic Catholics. But again, for the most part, whatever vestiges of Catholic charismatic renewal there are, they're pretty marginal and pretty small compared to the 1970s. And then things were pretty quiet during the 1980s, I'd say at least as far as most of us were concerned, but things were brewing. And in the 1990s, we find the outbreak of a new wave of revival, and I would call these probably the newest of the neo-Pentecostals, who are really continuing to push the envelope for revival and for the coming of this kingdom that I mentioned earlier.
Well, let me pause you right there, because that's what I want to come back to, and this is where you're picking up your new work, really looking at what is going on in the 1990s. I want to step back, and you use this term routinized, and you use that term in association with a number of the revivals after the Second World War in the 1960s and 1970s. When you talk about the routinization of charisma or the routinization of religion, what do you mean by this, and what kind of dynamics or changes does this lead for groups like Pentecostalism?
I have a little shorthand for that. In fact, it's a process that could be found in the works of William James, Max Weber, Ernst Troeltsch. I mean, they've described routinization in different ways. I kind of like Abraham Maslow, the humanistic psychologist, of when he wrote a book in the 1970s dealing with religion, values, and peak experiences. Of course, Maslow was very interested in peak experiences, and he contended that religion, with big R, was filled with non-peakers teaching other non-peakers about somebody else's peak experience.
And what do you mean by peak experiences?
Peak experience would have been a good example of it would be baptism of the Spirit, speaking in tongues, experiencing healing, experiencing prophecy, feeling that God has somehow visited you. Maslow would contend that every world religion, every big religion, was birthed out of somebody's experience. And he would have called that a peak experience. And that peak experience drew other followers who may have been having peak experiences. But over time, those experiences become less important, in a sense, than the institution that was birthed by them. Mm-hmm. And the institution itself becomes very unfriendly to experiences. Take, for example, mentioning the latter rain of the 1940s and early 50s. The Assemblies of God did not like the latter rain. They also almost condemned the charismatic movement. They came very close to condemning it, but decided not to. So somehow when the organization formed, and the, if you will, a kind of bureaucracy develops, they're not hospitable to this new, fresh experience. As one sociologist said, whatever else they are, religious experiences are institutionally dangerous. So we find the institution developing out of the experience, but then the institution becomes unfriendly to subsequent experiences. Because perhaps they inadvertently or advertently challenge the organization that is developed.
One could imagine a challenging of the power structures and the authority of the
you
clergy.
Got it. That's it. Take, for example, something like Youth with a Mission. Youth with a Mission is just celebrating its 50th anniversary. It was founded by a young Assemblies of God minister 50 years ago. And when he approached the then general superintendent of the Assemblies of God, telling him that God had told him, given him this vision, that there were going to be thousands of young people that would be sent out from this group that he would be leading to missionize the world, the general superintendent said, oh, that's nice, that's a nice vision, but, you know, we could use you here in Springfield, Missouri. We'll give you an office. We can't, you know, we don't see it the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lauren Cunningham said he understood why the general superintendent wouldn't be looking at this 25-year-old or 26-year-old and think that he had his head on straight, but he knew what God told him, and he had to go do it.
Right, right.
And the bottom line is he did do it.
Yeah, and this is in many ways how schisms arise in you know, religions throughout history.
That's exactly the way many of them arise. And it's hard to sort out the valid ones from the not valid ones. I mean, there's all kinds of people, when you live in this kind of an as-if world, can come up with some real harebrained schemes, too.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking before, in terms of when you give the power over to the congregation to really experience the faith, it can lead in a lot of many unpredictable directions, one would imagine. You know, people just saying, well, I'm going to take off on this youth mission, and I'm going to do this, and the hierarchy of the church, so, whoa, we need you here in that regard. So, and it seems not only to create schisms, but that seems to me to be one of the lifebloods of the revitalization of Pentecostalism. It
right.
just seems to be continually renewing itself.
Yes, that's correct. And it's messy.
Yeah. Let me talk about your earlier book, The Assemblies of God at the Crossroads, and this will help to bring us up to the 1990s and your current work to see what is going on over the last two decades. When you wrote that book, what were you thinking about in terms of the crossroads that the Assemblies of God was facing at that time?
I think they're still facing it. The crossroads between, do we do more and more according to bureaucratic rules, or do we do more and more led by the Spirit?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real tension between what I call charisma and institutionalization. And I think we need to leave the tension alive for charisma to exist, but the tendency is to try to quench the charisma so that the institution doesn't wobble.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of in a nutshell.
Let me ask you a little bit about that, because one of the things that's interesting about the Assemblies of God is that their official name is the World Assemblies of God Fellowship, and they tend to downplay that notion that they are a denomination, yet they're a pretty big organization. So what is the organization of the Assemblies of God like? Is it, would you consider it to be a classic denomination, say like the Presbyterians? Would you consider it to be a loose confederation? How would you consider it?
Okay. There's really almost two questions there. I see it almost like two organizations, and Assemblies of God are part of this worldwide group. When I was doing my original study on the Assemblies of God, I got the feeling that Springfield, Missouri, where the headquarters for the Assemblies of God is much like Mecca or Rome. It was the head of the Assemblies of God. That feeling is no longer there when I visit Springfield.
Hmm.
It's that the 63 million in the worldwide Assemblies of God have kind of moved, they are their own organization, and the Assemblies of God is simply one constituent member of that worldwide group.
Mm-hmm.
So we have two things going on here. So that's certainly one factor to consider when looking at the organization. So that fellowship of the worldwide is made up of a lot of constituencies. So that brings us to the American constituency. What does it look like? Despite all their attempts not to be a denomination, they are a full-fledged denomination.
Right.
And I pointed that out, I think, in the first book, that they were moving in that direction, or they were already there. They kept saying they were a fellowship even more than they do today, because now many people, when they say they're a fellowship, they kind of laugh along with it and say, what does that mean?
Yeah.
They're not even really a network of churches like some of the newer networks among neo-Pentecostals. They're pretty well institutionalized. And I developed that idea in my new book even more to demonstrate that they operate under different principles. You know, someone's private spirituality is very different from trying to run a large denomination.
I want to kind of ask, this is a little bit of a side tangent here, but it's related to this general question of, you know, is the Assemblies of God a denomination or a fellowship, and how does it fit into the Pentecostal rubric? When I tend to think of the Assemblies of God, well, there's two things I think of. One, in terms of Pentecostalism, most of my research is done on Latin America, so I see the very effusive worship that goes on in these places, the speaking in tongues, the rolling in the aisles, the shaking and such. But then when I think about the Assemblies of God, which is part of this Pentecostal umbrella, there are certain Assemblies of God churches around my area that don't look any different than your typical evangelical church. That one down the street, I could not tell you if I've ever heard speaking in tongues from there or that. It just seems average denomination in that regard. So has it been the case that the Assemblies of God, as they've moved to the suburbs, and I live in a fairly rural suburban area outside of Seattle here, has lost some of that passion as people move? The suburbanites, they're not the ones that are going to be speaking in tongues and shaking and such. Is that part of the reason why they've lost some of this passion?
Good question and good observations, Tony. First of all, I would say one of the, the strong points of the Assemblies of God is they allow room for a lot of diversity. And so you have a good deal of diversity among the congregations. In fact, in my book, I identify four different types, and they're ideal types. So congregations can be more or less that. And probably the biggest type is what I call evangelical Assemblies of God. And they're your plain vanilla evangelicals, although they still identify with the Assemblies of God, and you wouldn't even know. In fact, you can go into one of those churches, and many people won't even know it's a Pentecostal denomination. Some won't even know that they belong to the Assemblies of God.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there are still other churches that I would say are pretty traditional. And what do I mean by traditional? I mean they're very high on religious experience. And that's experiences even in the congregational context. And they also identify very much with the Assemblies of God. In fact, all of the ethnic churches in our new study, were classified as traditional. So the Euro-American Assemblies of God is probably getting more and more evangelicalized, more and more routinized, and I would say less and less Pentecostal, even if they keep the name Assemblies of God. But your average immigrant church, and those are the churches that are growing. It's not the Euro-American churches that are growing. It is the immigrant churches. So the Assemblies of God has continued to grow, but it's grown because people of color are joining and immigrant churches. So we're finding there are a lot of different Assemblies of God. And at the same time, the Assemblies of God also makes room for a truly what I would regard as a charismatic or Pentecostal church. I wanted the Neo-Pentecostals to become part of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have, and you can have groups that don't look like a traditional evangelical church or a traditional Pentecostal church being Assemblies of God. So there are a lot of different types that identified in the 22 congregations that we studied. What would you like me to develop perhaps out of one of those?
I do want to talk about that. I'm still want to be there at your book earlier, The Assemblies of God at the Crossroads.
Okay.
And one of the questions I have is, to what extent does the leadership in Springfield understand this? Do they understand this tension between the routinization and the charisma? And is it something that they wrestle with on a daily basis?
Well, they're not going to tell me whether they wrestle with it on a daily basis. Nobody ever promoted the first book, and I don't know that they'll promote the second one either, but it managed to get around anyway. And I have a lot of friends telling me that people in Springfield read me, even if they don't comment. I have a good relationship, I'd say, with some of the leaders in Springfield. And I'd say, you know, they're good people, and they do wrestle with this. And, I suppose I should point out the particular governing structure of the Assemblies of God. Springfield can only do so much. It's very much of a congregational government within the congregations, within the churches. So I had one minister tell me during my research for the 1989 book, for the Crossroads book, is he was very involved in the charismatic movement. And as I mentioned earlier, the charismatic movement was really in danger of being condemned by the Assemblies of God. And when I asked this minister how he was getting away with being so charismatic, he said, "I'm successful. They don't touch anyone who's successful."
Yeah.
So that was his response, and I think he was just being honest, not boasting. So they couldn't touch him as a local pastor who was successful. The only way they would move after some such person is perhaps if there was some sexual indiscretion. They do take after that, or divorce. But they don't usually bother the congregations that are doing well. So that's one part of the government. But the ministers, however, have more of a Presbyterian tie to the congregation. To the denomination. So it's the ministers that are accountable to Springfield. And again, the successful ones know how to dance around the problems. Ones who are not as successful or are little known sometimes can be made test cases of what the denomination does not approve. For example, again, out of my 1989 book, there was a young minister who was getting his doctorate in theology, and he could not accept the theology of tongues, that it was the initial evidence of spirit baptism. He said he couldn't find any biblical base for that. So he wound up writing a letter discreetly asking that they rethink about it. They defrocked him.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, similar kinds of things could happen today in different ways. I mean, that's the kind of ties that exist between, or like I mentioned, Youth with the Mission. Lauren Cunningham left the Assemblies of God to found Youth with the Mission. But the ties are, and in fact, that's another problem that the Assemblies are facing today, at least in talking to many ministers, is that the age of the average minister is increasing, that they're losing the younger ones. And part of the reason they're losing the younger ones, say these older ministers, is because there's so much emphasis on this doctrine of tongues, of having to acquiesce to it, when they don't feel they can do it, and they have to sign a statement that's stronger than the older people do. So there's all kinds of things going on, but again, you see the ties to the denomination on the part of the ministers, and they have to deal with that in ways the congregants don't.
Interesting tension going on there. You wrote that book in 1989, or published it in 1989.
That's right.
And you mentioned earlier in the podcast that something, again, there's a new revitalization movement going on in the 1990s, and this is where your current research is really picking up. So tell us what happens after that 1989 book. What do you see going on in the 1990s within the Assemblies of God and within Pentecostalism writ large?
Well, there's two questions there. Within the Assemblies of God, I didn't see it touched very much by revival, even though one of their churches, a Brownsville Assembly of God in Pensacola, Florida, was one of the epicenters. I did some research on that time with pastors, and I found that even though everyone knew about what was going on in Pensacola at Brownsville Assembly of God, only a third of them bothered to check out any of these revivals, any of them. And they didn't invite revivalists to come into their churches. So pretty much the Assemblies of God was not touched by that revival. There was a lot of discussion about it, but only a minority of churches would have been touched by it. And even those that were, perhaps one very interesting one is Bethel Church in Redding, California, because the pastor there, Bill Johnson, I think is a fifth-generation Pentecostal pastor, he left the Assemblies of God a couple of years ago because he found himself at the center of revival. The Assemblies didn't seem to mind because, again, he was very successful.
Right.
But he found that his networking was all outside the Assemblies of God. And so he said he really had to join a network or become part of a network that were really moving in the same direction he was. And I think the title of one of Bill Johnson's books says it all, When Heaven Invades the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, A Practical Guide to a Life of Miracles. And his church is really pursuing that. It's become a flagship for this neo-Pentecostal movement and revitalized movement. So, again, there's kind of like two things going on. You have the neo-Pentecostals perhaps pushing the envelope and the Assemblies of God going more and more evangelical.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you mentioned earlier, too, is the success recently of the ethnic churches. Now, when you mentioned that earlier, are you talking about ethnic Pentecostal churches, or is there an ethnic Assemblies of God movement?
Oh, there's a big ethnic Assemblies of God movement, and that's where the growth is in the Assemblies of God in the United States, in this ethnic movement. The Hispanics make up, you know, close to 20% of the Assemblies of God these days.
Mm-hmm.
And just to give you some idea of how an ethnic church might be founded, and one of the things that has always marked the Assembly of God is a real concern for mission. So there's a reason there are 63 million Assemblies of God people worldwide. Certainly the Americans were always big on mission. And it almost seems as if there's a reverse missionizing going on now.
Right.
In that some of the people are coming to serve the ethnic groups here. And here's one story. This is based on the congregation Jesus Power Assembly of God in Columbus, Ohio. And it was founded by Pastor Bismarck Okomia in I believe it was 2001. I'll just call him Pastor Bismarck. In 1986, Pastor Bismarck was working as a tailor and served as an active member of an Assemblies of God church in Ghana. He felt God called him into the ministry as an evangelist and as a church planter. So he was helping to plant churches in Ghana. But in 1999, God spoke to him again, and this time to move his family to the United States. So he packed up his family and moved them to Houston, where there was a community of Ghanaians that he was familiar with. But in 2001, after living in Houston for 2 years, God spoke another word to him, and this time it was move to Columbus, Ohio. Pastor Bismarck said he didn't even know there was such a place as Columbus, Ohio. He looked it up, packed his family, moved there that same year. And he started the church in June of 2001. Very shortly, he had, by the time I visited him, I think the first time probably in about 2004, this fledgling church was a pretty good-sized church of about 400 people. They had a building, and he had established four other congregations, a Swahili-speaking and a French-speaking congregation in Columbus, an African congregation in Cincinnati, and another one in Atlanta, Georgia. And keep in mind, he came to the United States, he came to Columbus in 2001, and working as a pastor at that point. 2005, he was ordained by the Assemblies of God finally, when they recognized, hey, this man has five churches.
Man, again, it goes to the point of, wow, he's very successful. Let's embrace
him. Exactly. But he was hearing God just doing whatever. In fact, in his interview with me, he said, you know, now they want me to come and speak at the different conferences. Like, what's your program, they ask me, he says. And I don't have a program. I pray. I just pray a lot. And his church prays a lot. He says, I pray, and you pastors have to know how to pray.
Yeah.
I don't have a program.
That's interesting. That story really highlights, you know, some of the tension between the routinization and the more charismatic aspects of the movement, in that, you know, you have the Assemblies of God saying, okay, what is your program? Can we see your blueprint? Put it down on a paper with the bullet point presentation. But he's basically saying, no, I've been filled with the Holy Spirit, and it's just happening as it goes along.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I don't know how many ethnic churches have been founded with those kinds of stories, but you're more likely to find those stories in ethnic churches. And again, it might be because, you know, let's say if you're an immigrant from Ghana, what kind of resources do you have? Not many, right?
Right. No, that's...
You have to rely on God, and that's what they do.
And those stories are absolutely fascinating. I'm going to recommend that our listeners actually pick up your book and read that story, because it's just... You know, it's fascinating, and actually it connects with one of the other aspects of your book that's in the title of the book that I want to talk a little bit more about, is that the issue of godly love, and how this really is a motivator for church expansion, church growth. We oftentimes think of church growth in the routinized ways of having a blueprint, but your book highlights this more emotional, spiritual aspect, and how that can really bring about change within religious movements. So tell us a little bit about what godly love is and how it plays into all this interaction with the Pentecostal and Assemblies of God movements.
Right. We have just held a commandment, we just held a seminar on godly love, and we titled it The Great Commandment, Theology and Social Science and Dialogue. And that seminar was just held from October 22nd to the 23rd at Vanguard University of Southern California. Fortunately, we videotaped it, so if anybody wants to really get into this, they will be able to find it on greatcommandment.blip.tv. That's greatcommandment.blip.tv. You can see all of this. But for now, just to give you some idea, what is this godly love? The concept of godly love we define for academic purposes as the dynamic interaction between divine and human love that enlivens and expands benevolence. Another way of putting it is, what is the interaction between grace, God's grace, and human nature that results in enlivened and expand benevolence? When we're talking to an academic circle, an academic circle are trying to do publications based on this, we talk about godly love. But another way of talking about it is to say godly love is simply a technical academic term for the Great Commandment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Great Commandment says to know and to love God with your whole heart, your whole soul, etc., etc. It implies a two-way relationship with God. The person reaching out to God in prayer, but not just a one-way, but God reaching back to person. It's a dynamic, ongoing relationship. It's what we study when we study religious experience. And so that's a very important first part of it. But the other one is like it. What is the relationship between people, between or among humans, that is empowered by this love relationship? Let me, you know, I'm going to go forth and just offer a little example that just comes from my own church from
Please
last
do.
Sunday. I belong to a small independent church in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, just adjacent to Akron, and it's called the Community of Believers. The community of Cuyahoga Falls is a community of modest means, and the church is located in an old business district. It was once a movie theater. And it's surrounded by homes and apartments, and many of these inhabited by lower working class people, or perhaps the working poor, or those on welfare. Community of Believers is pastored, has been pastored for some 15 years by Tom Bloom, someone who has, according to his own description, sometimes felt like a rope between a balloon and a basket. He often uses the hot air balloon model. There are some in his congregation that are revivalists. They're the balloonists. They want to go with this supernatural. Others want to stay safely in the basket, preferably on the ground. And he says he feels like you need both, and he's kind of straddling it. So when I talked in my book on the Assemblies of God about the tension that has to stay between the charisma and the institutionalization, I think that's just another way of expressing it.
Right.
So that's the church. But this is a church that might be labeled, in terms of a term that's being used now in social science, as a progressive Pentecostal church. It's very open to the supernatural gifts, but it wants to use these supernatural gifts for service. You know, that's where the benevolence comes in. So, for example, in the summer of 2009, the church was experiencing a budget deficit. It seems to typically do that. And yet, they were feeling that God was telling them to serve the poor in that area and to have a meal on Wednesday night, a free meal for anybody in the community that wants to come, to have groceries, and then to also have a little church service. So they were trying to reach out into their neighborhood, and they did it. They did it, they would say, on faith,
mm-hmm.
because they really didn't have the money. And yet, by the end of the year, they had the money, and the budget was balanced. Well, they not only try to serve the community, but they also try to reach out to missions. As I mentioned, Pentecostals have always been big on missions. And this past Sunday, some people came back after having ministered in the Ukraine. And their Ukraine ministry consists of helping some pastors who work among gypsy camps in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So twice a year, a small team travels to the Ukraine to equip leaders and to engage in other construction processes or to do something to help better the lives of the gypsy population or the Roma in the Ukraine. So some people had just come back last Sunday, and I was really struck by the sharing. The one young man was sharing how he had been praying for a gypsy woman who wanted healing, and he felt it was being blocked, and he thought it was being blocked because she was turning to him rather than to God, and he said he has no power to heal. And he told her that. He said, you have to turn to God. I don't have any power. Well, he saw her the next night just dancing away, obviously not saddled with the same problem she had the night before. And when he asked her what happened, she said that she was prayed for by another gypsy, another Roma, and she was healed.
Hmm.
And so he's telling that story. And then afterwards, the leader of the group, Dan Capps, said that he was so troubled when they left for the Ukraine because ordinarily they take some money with them to give to the church, and they really didn't have the finances to take along with them this time. And they didn't know how they would be received. But right from the start, the Spirit of God fell, and they had revival every night there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, as he was praying about that before the morning service, that he got the scripture passage made all the sense, and it had to deal with Peter's account in Acts when he was approached by the beggar, and Peter said, silver or gold I have not, but what I have I give to you. And he told the beggar to get up and walk. And basically, this is what Dan Capp said happened in the Ukraine. They didn't have the silver and gold, but they took the Spirit of God that they feel is in that community, our home community, and they took that. But in response, the people there caught it, and they were almost catching it back from them. He wasn't using the term catching, I am.
Right, right.
But they brought something back with them from that mission, and that was the Spirit again. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. It's the power of the Spirit who seems to be renewing, and what's required is an openness to that Spirit, and sometimes stepping out in ways that are really seem impossible or improbable.
And that's what I really like about your work, is that I tend to come at things from a more institutional perspective, and so I, and as I think many social scientists share this, we tend to dismiss that emotional aspect, the godly love aspect that you're talking about, because it's difficult to quantify or put into words. But as your work highlights, this is really a major avenue for church growth and for church planting, that
yeah.
The godly love just it's hard to explain in many ways. I mean, what are your thoughts about how this actually works from a social science perspective, or perhaps even, you know, the difficulties of trying to wrap your head around this from a social scientific perspective?
Right. Yeah, I've been trying to wrap my head around it for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think my first focus was on just religious experience and noting that social science wasn't paying enough attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't taking it seriously.
Yeah.
And now as we develop this concept of godly love, we found one, our model says, wait a minute, we pay a lot of attention to how people interact with other people, but for many people, God is a significant actor. And we can't prove God, we can't prove he really did anything or said anything, but we can look at what people say they believe God did, or what God said, or what they felt God do. We can take that account seriously. And when we took that account seriously, we found that it made a difference in benevolence. It was a factor in benevolence, much more so than any of our demographics. So it didn't matter how old you were, how young you were, or how rich you were, or how poor. The real factor seemed to be, what kind of relationship is a person having with God? And again, that's their own definition, their own account. We have no way of getting at it. But we can take people's accounts seriously.
Yeah, and it's you know, stepping into the shoes of others to really experience what they are experiencing or living through that. And I think that's what I really enjoy about your work is because that highlights it. Social scientists are oftentimes criticized for really sterilizing a lot of the religious experience, but your work has really been bringing that back, and I think a number of other scholars are really picking up on this as well and bringing the religious aspect more into religion once again.
That's right. Thank you, Tony. And, you know, I want to emphasize, too, that this godly love goes beyond Pentecostalism, because we did a national survey, and we actually studied Pentecostals first. We did a lot of interviews with Pentecostals and trying to get a sense of what kinds of questions to ask in our survey. And we use Pentecostals only because Pentecostals know how to tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
They frame it in ways that we were finding helpful, in ways that would not reduce it to something else. And then we ask questions that might be appropriate, we believe were appropriate for a larger audience. And we wound up doing a national survey. One of the things that we studied was what we call prophecy. And we asked questions like whether the person had experienced giving a prophecy privately to another person, whether the person had received a personal revelation from another, whether they heard a revelation of God during personal times of prayer, or heard God telling them to do something specific during prayer. And all of these were things that the majority of Americans had experienced at least once, but some of them on a very regular basis.
Yeah, I was actually surprised, you know, looking at your data, the high percentages of people who say they've given prophecy privately to another person. I think you have 48% of
48%, yeah.
Yeah, that, and then received a personal revelation from another 70%.
That's right.
Amazing.
Or received a revelation directly from God, 82%.
Yeah.
Hearing a divine call to perform a specific act, 74%. And that last item, incidentally, I asked years ago when I did research on prayer, and it was pretty similar. So we know that this is ongoing. And what we find is that, again, this is related to how does the person experience God?
Right.
And then does this experience of what we call prophecy here, a prophecy scale, how does that impact their loving other people? And it does. So, what we studied among Pentecostals, it just is perhaps they know how to talk about it more, and they have created context where there's more room for these kinds of experiences, but other people are experiencing them too, and it's having impacts outside, that's not unexpected, outside the Pentecostal tradition.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, as social scientists, I should say as human beings, we know is going on, but as social scientists, it's very difficult to really gather data on or, as I said earlier, to wrap our head around. I'm reflecting upon earlier podcasts that we did with Mark Driscoll of Mars Hill Church, and my goal of that interview was really to figure out, you know, how Pastor Driscoll took a small Bible study group in Seattle, Washington, one of the least churched areas in the country, and built it up to a mega church in a really short period of time. And I was really, in many ways, searching for, well, what institutional factors did you engage in? What kind of plans did you have? But it really kept coming back to what, you know, you are calling godly love. He didn't necessarily use that term, but he just says we're led by the faith and we're inspired by this. And for me, it's really kind of bringing home this aspect that, you know, religion is really about religion. And as social scientists, we really need to keep that in mind.
Well, you know, one reason, Tony, that we have been so limited is that we're also sometimes constrained by grantsmanship.
Right.
You know, and we haven't found an outlet of somebody willing to sponsor this kind of research. So I owe a great deal to the John Templeton Foundation,
mm-hmm.
and certainly to Sir John Templeton's vision to study unlimited love. That was one of his things. It was one of his interests, was unlimited love, what we're perhaps calling godly love.
Right.
So fortunately, doors are opening for this kind of research, and I'm hoping to see more and more of it in the future.
And we're hoping for a number of our listeners, our other scholars, and as well as graduate students I've heard have been listening to this program as well, that those doors are opening, and I urge you to actually pick up Margaret Paloma's work here and take a look at it, because I think it is a very fruitful path to be pursuing research on. And as you noted, the Templeton Foundation is really stepping up and funding a lot of this research that might otherwise be ignored by the National Science Foundation or other institutions such as that. So definitely want to thank you for path-breaking this style of research and this method of research and bringing these issues to our attention. And again, I want to thank you for joining us today on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony, for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.